Welcome back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. Yes, Adley Rutschman might be coming up this week. We'll talk some baseball around here, but they're running a little race this week. And despite the fact that the Kentucky Derby winner is not coming here, I'm still going to talk about it all week long. And we're excited about perhaps having a new track and different things here. We're dreaming the dream of maybe even a World Cup and a new track in 2026. She's been coming here and doing the backstretch and being there after winners and happy, usually with happy people, sometimes in foul weather conditions on NBC. Donna Brothers joins us as she does annually every year to usually discussing the state of racing and where we are. This is a new one. It's been a long time since Spend the Buck, and I remember all that, that we're talking about a Preakness without the Derby winner.
Yeah. You know what? I went out to Eric Reed's place in, it's not far from me. I live in Louisville's my home base. And so they're in Lexington, Kentucky. And I went out there, what was it, this past week on Friday morning. And I talked with Eric about it because he was telling me how great the horse came out of the race. I asked him, like, do you normally walk the horse for 3 days after the race? Is that your normal? He said, I actually do. But he said he came out of the race so good that the second day after walking, we took him out grazing and he was shadow boxing with the groom, like rearing up. And so we took him back to the track on day three. And I said, OK, you say that, but then you also say you feel like he's not ready to run back in the Preakness in 2 weeks. I don't really understand. And he said, look, Donna, if I'm honest, did I really think he was going to win the Derby? No, I thought he'd run well. He said, our plan all along was that if he made a decent showing, finished in the top half, we would go on to the Belmont Stakes from there because we knew the more ground for the better for him. He said, but, you know, there's been 13 Triple Crown winners and the likelihood of us being the 14th are pretty low. You know, we were long odds to win the Derby. And he said, I feel like his best race is going to be in the Belmont Stakes. And I feel like I'm going to take that race away from him if I run him back in 2 weeks now. So I don't feel like the mile and 3/16 is going to be suitable for his running style, for his preference for longer distances. So it all made sense when he talked about it, but certainly we were all disappointed not to have the Derby winner back. But you know what I heard? The bigger picture of what I heard from what Eric said was, how can I say that I take care of my horses if I don't do what's right for the horse here? And while people say, you know, this, but it's about sportsmanship, it's the best thing for the sport, I would disagree, because if we don't put our horses first, then we're not putting our sport first. So really what's in the best interest of the sport is to put the horses first. And that's what Eric Reed's done.
We've just come out of the gate and with a fury here. Donna Brothers is here. You can follow her work. She'll be here all week long celebrating another Preakness, 147, 92 degrees in the forecast, at least early in the week. So we're going to have some weather to go along
late
with this
in the week, too. I think right now the high for Saturday is supposed to be 94.
Yeah, well, we'll be 100. It'll be hot down on the track. Listen, we watched. I was up on Long Island seeing John Mayer. I was actually at Elmont, New York, the day of the Kentucky Derby. And I was in the kitchen with my buddy. We're watching the race. And we had the sound down, and we were just kind of watching. And when the race ended, the horse did something that I guess you see horses do all the time. But that was one rambunctious horse after that race, right?
Actually, I've never seen a horse do it. As you know, Nestor, I've been involved with horse racing my entire life. My mother was a jockey. I've ridden, I don't know how many thousands of races, won over 1,200. Never seen a horse take a sustained attack on another horse after the race. So I've seen a horse maybe pull up to the outrider pony and take a nip at him, maybe even two nips. But usually just jerking them off one time is all the persuasion they need, and they're tired by then. I've never seen a horse take a sustained assault on the outrider and his horse. And in this case, he bit the outrider on his arm, I think three times, bit him on his leg several times. I saw pictures on Twitter where he literally got hunks of hide out of his horse's neck. And so people have asked, you know, like, why don't they just wear like some sort of guard on the horse's neck and on the outrider? And two things. Number one, those saddle horses are neck reined. They don't plow rein. They don't steer by pulling on each rein. They steer the kind of horse the outriders ride. They steer by leaning the rein against their neck. So if you've got a guard on there, it makes them a little bit difficult to manipulate. But the other thing is that a suit of armor is not typically required for the job. Typically, the horse doesn't get attacked and the rider doesn't get attacked. And so my favorite question all week has been, why didn't you do the post-race interview? So my answer has been, Well, you know, I really didn't want to end the Kentucky Derby 148 by being mauled, possibly dragged off my horse and trampled. So we decided to decline the interview.
Yeah, I, you know, it was, you're telling me it's unprecedented. I thought this happens to some degree, horse pretty tired, right, at that point, right? Too tired to sort of pick a fight, right?
In theory, yes. But, you know, Eric Reed was on the Today Show on Monday morning after the Derby. And the way that he read it, I guess, because we don't really know what was in the horse's mind, but the way he took it is that they spent a lot of time teaching Rich Strike to pass horses. When they first got him, he was intimidated by other horses. And so they spent a lot of time, and this is something he told me actually at the training center, getting him to sit behind like two or three horses and at the end of the gallop, go by him. So they taught him to be, you know, more aggressive and to pass these horses. And he said, the only thing that I can figure, and this is what he said on the Today Show, is that he felt like he had passed all the horses and now this guy grabs him and he won't let him buy his horse. And now there's other horses who are galloping back after the race and they're going and he wants to go with them. And he just felt like he was being kept from doing his job and he got angry by that. Now, meanwhile, the outrider's job is to bring that horse and rider safely back to the winner's circle after the Kentucky Derby. You have to keep in mind there's 150,000 people there, right? So when the Derby winner comes galloping back in front of that crowd, the crowd has this huge uproar. And a lot of times horses will shy from that. They'll literally be galloping along and then just stick their toes in the sand, turn around and go the other way and leave the rider where they are. And so as much energy as he finished up with and as inexperienced as he is in front of that sort of crowd, I could see that situation could have been much worse if the outrider had just let him go. So if he had galloped back without the outrider holding on to him and dropped his rider, that certainly could have been a much worse situation.
Well, I mean, certainly this horse and what, where were you? Where do you watch the race? Because you're so available. You know, the minute the race is over, we see you. We usually see in normal times, roses, jockeys, you know, tears, excitement, previous winner, new winner, all of that. And you have all that at your disposal. Like watching that race and the way it ended and the memorable, I mean, just crazy memorable in so many ways, and a shame again that this horse isn't coming to Baltimore and the stories that come with it as well. But in those last 15 seconds of the race where it looked like a different kind of race, for you to even study up on the 21st horse in the race to even know that that horse would even be there, and watching it on a monitor for someone who watches a lot of racing like you, astounding race, right?
Yeah. So to answer your first question, where did I watch the race? I'm standing behind the starting gate as the horses are loading into the gate on my saddle horse. And as they start to load the last couple of horses in, I'll take off jogging the wrong way of the racetrack, meaning the opposite direction that the horses are going to run. And I'll make it to around that, what is going to be their second turn, my first turn. And I'll stop and wait for them. About that time, they've now turned up the backside. And so they're running toward me, but I just stand there and wait for them to run by. So that's my 1 second to sort of get, not 1 second, I'd say I have about 10 seconds to get a nice view of how much horse each rider has under them. And so I get sort of a snapshot of the race. But the whole time I'm listening to the call of the race in my ear from our announcer, Larry Colmus. And I'm not trying to watch a big, we have the big screen at Churchill. I don't try to watch that because it's just too much information. So sometimes it gets to a point where there's only so many things that your brain can take in.
And so you're listening to the race more than watching it.
So I'm listening to the race. I'm watching that, you know, sort of moment in time as they go by. And then I have to ride my horse in front of, there's also a crowd on the backside. And so I'm galloping along. Now, as soon as they go by me, I take off the wrong way again to meet them on the backside. And there are people on the outside fence that are screaming. And so I'm also paying attention to whether or not my horse that I'm riding is going to spook from anybody. So I can't also be watching. So I listen, ride my horse, get into position. You asked how I'm prepared, right? So this is my program. And you can see all these notes. And then on number 21.
But you don't see the race particularly well to be the person on television 10 seconds later. You don't, you
yeah,
really.
I'm going to get to that in a second. So on number 21, you can see all these notes. And so I had gone up to the jocks room earlier in the day to meet Sonny Leon because I'd never met him. So I learned an awful lot about him. And so all those notes are in my program, but I don't need to see the race. And, you know, Nestor, I used to see that as a liability because here I am interviewing somebody about a race that they just ran in that I didn't see. But what I eventually learned, and it took a while for me to figure this out, is that unless that horse has been in front or laying 1, 2, 3 the whole race, 90% of our viewers have no idea where that horse was in the early stages. They have no idea where the horse came from, right? And so it actually ends up being better because I can, from my position, say, you know, Sonny, now if I would have had the chance to interview him, it would have been something along the lines of, Sonny, from the position that I am on my horse, I wasn't able to see the race. Can you walk us through those early stages? And as he starts to talk about that, we have a great, as you know, production staff at NBC. And so the producers, directors might go ahead and run in a replay of that section of the race that Sonny talks about. And then I might even say, you know, right now they're showing you going into the first turn. Can you talk about your decision to drop over to the fence? And so they'll kind of tell me a little bit in my ear what they're showing. And it does help that I really don't know where the jockey was, because it gives me the chance to ask the question and genuinely seek an answer. And our viewers, I think, appreciate it.
Gotta love having her on. Donna Brothers is here. She's here. It's Preakness Week. And we're talking about the last race and this race and your unique role in all of this, because I know a lot of people who do what you do for a living in baseball, football. They're usually pretty engaged with what's happening because they have to, and you're not offered. I knew you didn't get a good look at the race, you know, but I didn't realize. But I mean, your expertise in all of this and pre-prep on all of that gets us ready for this race. So
yeah, but you know what? At the end of the day, you think about it, Nestor, it's the Kentucky Derby. The last thing you really care about is where exactly that horse was going into the first turn, right? Where you want to hear from that jockey at that time. And the whole purpose of me being there in the immediate aftermath of that race is to talk to that jockey while they're still in their heart, before they have a chance to process everything into their head. And so my immediate goal actually is to keep them in their hearts. So my first question is never going to be, tell me about your trip. Like, how did you get here? My first question is going to be, with Sonny Leon, it would have been along the lines of, oh my God, you just pulled off one of the biggest Kentucky Derby upsets in the history of the Kentucky Derby. Nobody believed in this horse. You've ridden him his last 3 races. What did you believe in him? Like, it would have been that. And it would have been, you know, you came here from Venezuela 7 years ago. You've been riding at, you know, racetracks a lot of our viewers have never heard of. Leading rider at Mahoning Valley, yes. But did you really think you could win the Kentucky Derby? And what is it? So that's where I would have gone anyway. It's the Kentucky Derby. Nobody cares what position you got leaving the gate in that immediate aftermath.
But it was a race. I mean, it was the race of all races for the winner, right? And that overhead cam, you know, the next couple of days, millions and millions of people, you'll never see that again. Don, I want to go back to taking care of horses because Bob Baffert's not here and has been pariahed out on this thing. The horse that won isn't coming. We've talked for years about this as a possibility. And I go back to 85 and Spend a Buck. And I remember that was a scandal, you know, at that time, that the Kentucky Derby winner and the state of New Jersey and all the things that went into it. This time it's about, I don't think my horse can win. I want to take care of my horse. I think we can win this other race. But that's, you know, in Baltimore, where we're fighting with Stronach, getting the building that you'll be in this week, that you'll see where we are in another year, but we're trying to make this something. We can't have this happen, right? I mean, I think to most people who love horses, you would say 2 weeks, probably not the greatest idea. Yeah, probably we probably could think this through a different way. How can we envision in the next 5-10 years that maybe it's not 2 and 3, maybe because the industry moves that way and horses and care for horses move that way, that this will be a very sensible fix for the industry?
I mean, we've talked about it for a long time. I still think it's a good idea. Randy Moss, my colleague, I don't know if you've had him on, but he really makes the most compelling case for moving it to first Saturday in May, first Saturday in June, first Saturday in July, give every, you know, one of those tracks the chance to make it like a much bigger day. The other reason beyond, let's just get past the Derby, is that I don't know if you saw the great racing that happened on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at Churchill Downs, but unless they were in the Kentucky Derby or the Oaks, the chances of them thinking about running back in any of the stakes races on Pimlico's weekend it's not going to happen, right? Because they just ran 2 weeks ago. And so they're going to look for a race further down the road for those other horses. And so if they moved it to where it was a month out, then not only would we see more horses, like the Todd squad, Todd Pletcher almost never comes back from the Derby into the Preakness Stakes. He might bring some new shooters in, but he doesn't bring his Derby horses back unless they won the Derby, like Super Saver did. But you also don't give Pimlico the chance to just develop a great weekend of racing because so many of those horses just ran 2 weeks ago at Churchill Downs. And so there's certainly a case to be made for it. I think it was a bigger scandal back in the day because people did run their horses every 3, 4, 7 days apart. And so not to run back in 2 weeks would have seemed like a bit of a scandal. And then that might not even been the spacing then because they did run them a lot closer together. But in any event, it's just not the way we race horses anymore. We race horses every 4 to 8 weeks. And I think 4 weeks is the right number. It's quick enough back and it gives the other two tracks, a chance to be able to develop a really nice stakes program around that weekend where they really have a really nice festival of racing for that weekend.
I want a Thurby. I didn't even know what a Thurby was till this week.
Yeah. And so in Louisville, Thurby has become the locals where if you just
I
go back,
the Oaks was locals. That's what they taught me 20 years ago.
10 years ago, the Oaks was the locals. But in the last 10 years, it's progressed to the point where, first of all, if you buy Derby tickets, and I don't know if you ever have, but if you call Churchill Downs to get your Derby tickets, what you're buying is an Oaks and Derby package. And so they've sort of priced it that way. And so most people have no choice but to either, you know, use both halves of that ticket or maybe they've got a friend who will use it one day and they'll use it the other day. But most people are already paying for an Oaks and Derby package. And so Thurby has become the locals' day to go to the track, but it's a huge day of racing. I mean, we've got a lot of stakes races on Thurby. So yeah, it makes sense for everybody. It would be a win-win for the horses, the horsemen, for Pimlico, and for Belmont Park.
Donna Brothers is here. She will be there at Pimlico and at the Preakness 147 this week. And of course, on your television screen. And I want to get to your charities, your book, all the things you're doing. But we got to talk about the race itself. I mean, Epicenter, where it is, where it was, how the betting will be, you know, along this early voting as well. Good race, though. Still a good race.
Oh, yeah. A really good race. I mean, even the horses that you think of as having like less of a chance, a horse like Creative Minister, Kenny McPeak, thinks enough of this horse who's had 3 starts so far in his lifetime, comes off of a win, same weekend of the Kentucky Derby, that he and his owners are supplementing for $150,000 to make him Triple Crown eligible to run in the Preakness Stakes. And so Kenny McPeak owns 10% of the horse. So he's putting up $15,000. He's got 2 owners in there who own 45% apiece. And so they're putting up the rest of the money to run him in the Preakness Stakes. And of course he won with the Philly, Swiss Skydiver won the Preakness Stakes and beat Medina Spirit. Simplification runs back, who I felt like ran a valiant effort to be fourth in the Kentucky Derby. He really never runs a bad race. It's really easy to get behind Antonio Sono and Tammy Bobo, the owner. You've got a local horse, Fenwick, who's going to give the Preakness a try. And who could forget Wayne Lucas running Secret Oath, the filly who won the Kentucky Oaks, is coming back in the Derby. I mean, in the Preakness Stakes, reminiscent of 2009 when we saw that with Rachel Alexandra. So we'll see if she's another Rachel Alexandra. I don't know about that. But early voting, who we really wanted to see run in the Kentucky Derby after his valiant effort, I would say, a second place finish in the Wood Memorial, he's going to run back. And so it's going to be a good race. Armagnac's in there. He's a horse who Starlight and SF Racing own in a partnership. He's shipping from California. He's a horse that won last time out in a nice race, not this level, but they feel like he's doing well enough to give him a chance. And so I think it's still going to be a great race, but Epicenter is the clear favorite, and I think, I mean, I loved him in the Kentucky Derby. He was my pick in the Kentucky Derby. So unless I see something drastic change between now and then, Epicenter is still going to be the horse that I think is going to win it and the horse that I'm going to pick. But it's still going to be a great race.
You and most other people at 6 to 5 here this week. Tell me about your book and tell me about the work that your book's doing, because I think it's sort of a wonderful concept anytime this time of year when my wife's going to put on a hat and look beautiful. And she's been on the yoga mat. You know, she's really gotten in shape, Donna. She looks better than me. I have to now catch up. She's always looked better than me, but I'm really falling further behind.
She's spending
here.
More time on the yoga mat than you, Nestor.
Yes, she is. Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, but not sure. Lately, the last couple of weeks, I've been a good doobie. I'm back on the mat. I'm doing my sweating. I'm doing my laundry, you know, trying to get in beach shape here. But I would just say when people go,
I lost your volume.
Go to the track. Especially
there
for
we go.
And listen, it's been, oh, I'm sorry. It's been 15 years since I been to the Derby, but I went for Oaks and the 2-day package and experienced it many times at the turn of the century. I think it's still the great, and I say it all week long, it's the greatest event in America. I've been to 28 Super Bowls. I know your friend Randy Moss has been to a few too, and I'll have him on later in a week, but there's nothing like the Derby, and everyone I talk to says it's bigger and better than it's ever been. And when I've gone there, it's so cultural to where you're from that most places you go, whether it's church, supermarkets, schools, wherever, people know a lot about horse racing there. I would say it would be a little lacrossey here, but baseball was always that way here during most of my lifetime, where people are just immersed in the culture of what it is, in the way Kansas is the basketball, or Indiana, or auto racing would be if you're in Charlotte, or open wheel in Indianapolis. But Baltimore, I've been doing this 31 years. I don't know a whole lot of people that read the form. You know what the track has looked like for long, long periods of time on weekdays. That this open door to you holding up that form that looks like Chinese literature to some people, that teaching people about the game is essential for anyone. And I say that about baseball that's really struggling here. But when you have wisdom that you have and you want to share it and you want people to fall in love with the sport, that's really what horse racing needs. I fall in love with it every year, but I don't go back every month, and I should. And part of that's marketing and this and that and the facility, but I do love it when I go, and I always seek to learn more. And it's people like you that write books that teach people.
Well, Nestor, one of the reasons why you love it when you go is because you understand the sport. If I sit here and watch a football game with my husband, he loves football. He's not a detail person, though, so he never understands the rules. So I'll say, well, why was that a flag on the play? And he'll say, oh, I don't know, sweetie. I hate that. I want to know why it was a flag on the play. I want to understand the sport, right? And so I like to I have girlfriends who understand the details of football better than he does, and I'd rather watch a game with them because they can explain to me why that was a flag on the play, right? And so with horse racing, I feel like if people understood it better, they too would embrace it better. And for example, I realize, like, when you hold up, look at these past performances, it does look like it's like it's written in code. I learned to read that when I was 6 years old, and I'm not a genius. I'm not particularly a brainiac. And so it really just takes somebody showing you line by line what every single thing in there means. And then once you see it, it's like, oh, I can speak the language now, right? And so I had been covering horse racing for a few years, and I kept saying, somebody needs to write a horse racing 101 book. You know, this language we have is really inside. I mean, if we say that horse looked like Secretariat, the casual viewer, one, doesn't know who Secretariat was. Two, if they did know who Secretariat was, they might know that he's a chestnut, and they might go, oh, when they say he looks like Secretariat, they mean he's also a chestnut, which of course isn't what we mean. We mean he's fast, looks super talented. In any event, finally, I decided nobody's going to write this book, so I got to write the book. So it's called Inside Track, Insider's Guide to Horse Racing. You can buy it on Amazon. It's in its third printing, third edition, because it needed some updates. The second edition was in 2014. And then, of course, we had, after a 37-year drought, Triple Crown winner in 2015. Luckily, I waited till 2020 to do that third update, because again, we had another Triple Crown winner in 2018. But the thing about the book is it's got a glossary of terms. every single chapter is a standalone chapter. So if you want to understand more about how to handicap, and that's it, read that. If you want to know more about what's where to the races, if you want to know more about where these jockeys come from, you know, what it takes to train a racehorse, how do you train a horse? Is it like training a dog? Names that you should know, just names from people in the past, you know, Hall of Fame trainers, jockeys, great horses that you should probably know, great racetracks that you can go to. Anyway, so I wrote the book, and then 2 years ago, I decided, you know, I was kind of embarrassed to talk about the book because I didn't want people to think that I was just promoting myself or trying to make money. Again, I felt like the book needed to be out there. I feel like if you don't need it, you've got three friends who probably do that you'd like to have understand the sport better. And so my way of being able to feel like I could promote it better and really get it the recognition that it needs is if I donated 100% of the profits to the Thoroughbred Aftercare Alliance for Thoroughbred Aftercare. So Thoroughbred Aftercare is something I'm passionate about. I believe anybody involved in our industry has become more and more aware of how important it is, because at the end of the day, we're going to be judged by how we take care of our animals, not only when they're racing, but maybe especially when they're no longer able to race. And so for me, Thoroughbred Aftercare is essential, and that was a win-win for me.
Tell me about Thoroughbred Aftercare real quickly and what they do, because, you know, I the first horse I ever touched was Ferdinand. And Ferdinand's end of Ferdinand's life was well documented. And I think knowing, and my wife loves horses, right? So just knowing what happens to American Pharaoh might not happen to every horse.
Yeah, absolutely. So what you're meaning with American Pharaoh is he's certainly a happily ever after. He's standing at stallion. And when he's no longer able to perform as a stallion, he'll live in a green pasture somewhere and have a happy, happy ending. But in Ferdinand's case, he was sent to another country as a stallion when he wasn't as productive in the U.S. anymore. And unfortunately, it was a country where they processed animals for meat, for human consumption. And that's, you know, the story of Ferdinand. And so a lot of people started to realize, like, we have to really pay attention to what's happening to our horses. And not just the first person you sell it to after it's no longer able to race, but down the line. And so the Thoroughbred Aftercare Alliance itself is not an aftercare organization. What the Thoroughbred Aftercare Alliance does is they are an accreditation body for aftercare organizations. So now if you donate money to an aftercare organization, as long as it's TAA, Thoroughbred Aftercare Alliance, accredited, then you know that it's a good organization and the money's going where it should. The second thing that the TAA does is we're a fundraising body for Thoroughbred Aftercare organizations. This year, we have 81 organizations that we are, we read the applications that they have for grants, and we give grants to these places. Now, keep in mind that we're only able to provide some of their money that they need. So when these organizations are raising money, they need to. So the Thoroughbred Aftercare Alliance raises some of the money, but they still have to raise a lot of the money themselves. So if you want to donate to aftercare, just make sure that the organization that you're looking at is TAA accredited. And if you just want to find one in your area, you can go to the Thoroughbred Aftercare Alliance website. You can click on organizations and you can even organize them by state. So you can see which ones are in your particular state, your particular region.
So 86, out at the Preakness with Charlie Ekman. It's Preakness Week, and the beautiful horses there. Charlie Whittingham walking around. Is it any wonder that 36 years later, I'm here talking about horse racing with you, Donna Brothers?
No, I mean, I've heard so many people who say, you know, like once they were exposed to horse racing, they were a fan for life. And I think Rich Strike, by the way, did that to a lot of people in Kentucky Derby. I heard a lot of people on social media channels who messaged me and said, oh my gosh, I've never really been exposed to horse racing. Can't really say that I was a huge fan, but I was at a Derby party. And when I saw that horse win against all odds, it inspired me and I am hooked. So he was good, not good for this year's Preakness, but good for horse racing.
Yeah, well, good for me too, because I'm a Venezuelan descent. So like when, yeah, you know, the jockey does that, I'm like, I knew it had to have been a Venezuelan to come from that far behind. So that was a little piece of that as well. Todd, well, appreciate you.
Your horse, you know, then for Preakness, the simplification, because Antonio Sano trains, and he's a guy who left Venezuela because of the just the volatility in the country. He had actually been kidnapped in that country twice, held once for 36 days. And so simplification, that's going to be your horse.
Now, we'll get some odds. We're going to do an exacta. I'm going to be boxing things and having fun. Preakness 147 is here. It gives me a great chance to share my airwaves with great folks who know a lot about the industry this week, including Donna Brothers. You can follow her at Donna B. Brothers out on the Twitter thing. Go buy her book, support her organizations. And we'll be watching this week as well as up in Elmont in a couple of weeks as well. Appreciate you.
Anytime.
Donna Brothers joining us here from the great state of Kentucky, where they're all packing and coming to Baltimore this week, despite the fact that the Kentucky Derby winner's not here. We'll be talking about that, the new track, how it may align with World Cup in 2026, as well as a potential with Adley Rutschman around here this week. I am Nestor. We are WNST, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore, and we never stop talking Baltimore positive.